It's hardcore history.
Addendum.
We told you when we first unveiled the Hardcore History Addendum feed that this was going to be the everything else feed. Anything that didn't belong in the main Hardcore History feed for one reason or another will end up here. We knew there would be interview shows because compared to what we normally do, the big Hardcore History shows, interview shows are simple. So we knew that there'd be quite a few of those and that we would try to switch them up and do them differently, like the one we did recently where I was the one who got interviewed. And then we knew there'd be some funky kind of shows that probably would upset some people on the main feed, but that some people would really like our Caesar at Hastings show, which we put on this feed. And then sometimes it's what probably could easily pass for a Hardcore History show, but for one reason or another, it's not the right time or place. We have the one that we did on Alexander the Great's mother that had we put it out on the main feed, it would have interrupted an ongoing series, so we put it out on this feed. So I hope that over time, when you look at the archives of the Hardcore History Addendum show offerings, you know, en masse, you will have an eclectic grab bag of potential offerings, you know, that looks pretty varied. I'd hate to fall into any ruts. Case in point, today's offering. There's a new movie out that touches my heart in all the right places, as you know. It's about Second World War naval history, so it's right up my alley. Has to do with a commander of one of these escort ships guarding merchantmen across the Atlantic during the Battle of the Atlantic and trying to keep the U-boats off of them. It's called Greyhound, by the way. It's on Apple TV Plus. Stars Tom Hanks, who's done a lot of World War II history movies or who's been involved in producing them or executive producing them. He's a history fan, I think. And by the way, I think he even did the screenplay of the movie. It's great. You'll like it. You should check it out. And in an unusual move, I think, that I hope will be part of that eclectic grab bag of offerings, when you look at our archives over time, you'll notice, hey, they did a Hardcore History addendum with Tom Hanks. And we did. And here it is. And by the way, if you don't know who Tom Hanks is, well, I don't know where you've been hiding, but maybe Google that. In any case, ladies and gentlemen, Tom Hanks. Mr. Hanks, can you hear me okay? This is Dan.
I can indeed, Dan. You can call me Tom, and it is a thrill to hear your voice on something other than one of the many podcasts. You, sir, are as big as Bruce Springsteen in our house.
I'm not quite sure how to react to that as a man who's been watching since Bosom Buddy days.
Well,
so.
Okay, all right. We were just, we just drove from Los Angeles, myself and two of my kids, we drove from Los Angeles to Twin Falls, Idaho, during which we listened to the entirety of Ghosts of the Ostfront, which was just one of, oh my Lord, I've learned so much from you and have been in your enthralled by you for many an hour. So thank you for your passion and thank you for your output, and it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be speaking to you now.
You know, as a guy who remembers pulling out my hair at like 25, going, "What the hell are you doing with your career at this point?" To hear you say that, to hear you say that is wonderful. I'm sure you know because I was doing my research. Let me start with this. As a guy who would have thought of you as the great comic genius coming up during the era when I was growing up, if you had told me back in 1980. That you were going to be one of the great dramatic actors of our time, and that you were going to have an IMDb page that looked like you were an overachiever with some sort of inefficiency attitude going. I mean, I look at what you've been doing, and you don't look like you've lived long enough to do all those things. I want to ask you someday what the hell an executive producer does, because you've been an executive producer. Yeah, tell me.
I can answer that. Yeah. Okay. There's a distinct difference between being an executive producer on a motion picture, which is literally a powerless title that doesn't even require your presence, to being an executive producer on a television series, in which you get to impact the final product as much as you wish to. You can get involved in the writing. You can get involved in the casting and the shooting. You can get involved in the editing. You actually can run, as long as you're the executive producer of a TV, anything on television, TV, miniseries, series, You get to run the quality assurance of that show. You get to be the big boss man if you decide to do so. Meaning that if you think something is running off the rails, you go in and put it back on. Or if it's something running incredibly smoothly, you just call up and tell everybody they're doing a slam bang job and keep an eye on it. So two very different things. So the things that I have been executive producer on television, particularly the miniseries, I've had a hand in the way I put it is assuring, literally running the quality assurance of those. On motion pictures, it doesn't mean anything.
Well, let's talk about your choices then, because as a guy who thought you were going to be this great comic leader of a movement, basically in our time period. I mean, I thought it was a brand new kind of comedy. To watch you choose the kind of topics that I would choose for a history show, you know, we made this show originally with history fans in mind. I feel like a history fan can recognize one of his own. You are a true fan of history, aren't you? I mean, in your own private time, in your own choice of reading materials, tell me a little about what Tom reads at home.
I read history for pleasure. Now, that being said, I'm not a scholarly reader. I don't read tomes. I have a confession to make. I've never been able to make it too deep into the rise and fall of the Third Reich, just because the numbers and the math start driving me nuts. I don't think I need to invest in the wheat productions from Saxony during the Weimar Republic. It ends up kind of like burying me. When I started reading history, I ended up reading historical novels like Mila 18 or Armageddon, things by Leon Uris that were, turgid melodrama in a lot of ways, but also ripped right out of the history books. And so I ended up finding out and being enthralled by eras and moments and periods of history. I read a lot of Don Miller's work. The building of the Supreme City, for example, which is about architecture in New York. I have read an awful lot of World War II stuff. I read an awful lot about communism. I read an awful lot about East Germany. I've had a copy of it for a long time, but Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States of America, because as a guy who has been reading history for pleasure and enlightenment and entertainment, I'm 64. I've been reading it like that really since I was like 13, 14 years old. When I started reading for pleasure, I was reading history. I was not aware, Dan, of the Tulsa Black Wall Street destruction in 1921.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I had never been taught that in American history. I had never heard about it. I literally learned of it just last May in an article in the New York Times. And I thought, this is a huge gap. this is a massive whiff, a miss of something that would have altered my consciousness. Let me go back just a little bit farther. When we took on doing David McCullough's John Adams,
yes,
for HBO, Graham Yost, who I'd worked with on the two previous miniseries, he called up and said, "Look, I can't do this, but you might want to take a look at this because I think there's a miniseries in this thing." And really, John Adams with what, the Tea Party and the three corner hats and the buckles on their shoes? Haven't we seen this stuff before? And he said, just read it. I said, okay. So I read it. When I got up to the place where, as an attorney in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, John Adams took on the case of defending the British soldiers that fired on the mob that became known as the Boston Massacre.
And nobody wanted that gig, by the way.
Nobody wanted the gig. Nobody wanted to take it. It was unpopular, and everybody hated the lobster backs.
I love that term.
Right? John Adams said, if we let the mob rule, we're doomed. That is not the that is the very rule of law is based on certain respects for each other, among other, for authority. But it is the opposite of letting a mob decide what goes on. So he takes on that case. I'm going to say there's a dozen British soldiers who just want to go. They just want to go home. This cold, miserable country where everybody hates them. Can we please go home? Not only does John Adams defend them, but he wins their acquittal by way of the rule of law. If I had been told somewhere, I think the first time American history was a subject that we had to take a requirement. I believe I was 10 in fifth grade and then again in eighth grade and any other time in the course between then and now. If I had been told the future second president of the United States, the future first president of the United States, one of the authors of the Declaration of Independence, had defended British soldiers for firing upon a mob, for being responsible for the Boston Massacre, and proved the circumstances that led to their acquittal and being sent home, my head would have exploded. It would have been an exaggeration of the very reason why certain things are written down on parchment and accepted as these truths that we hold to be self-evident, the workings of we the people in order to make a more perfect union. It would have influenced me in a huge way, and perhaps I would have been pissed off. Hey, wait a minute. The British are the bad guys, right? How come we're getting, why would we celebrate them getting up? Because it's the rule of the law. All right. Take two. I could talk about this stuff. Take two. The representative of the United States of America, first ambassador to the court of St. James, a place where if things had been different, he would have been brought in chains and hung by the King of England. He now has to, John Adams, future vice president of the United States, co-author of the Declaration of Independence.
Father of another U.S. president.
Father of another U.S. president. Both of them one-termers. Thank you very much. he now, because we are no longer an English colony and protected not only by the crown, but also by the crown's imperial navy, the big empire of the navy, America now has to go and they essentially negotiate all the deals that were already made by England because now they're their own country. So one of the things he has to do is go talk to the Barbary pirates who have enslaved American sailors that they've taken on the ship.
In North Africa, yes.
In North Africa. That's the way they did things. They kidnapped a bunch of people. They got tribute, and that's how they made money. They dealt in hostages. They had dealt in kidnapping. And the John Adams goes and speaks to the emir of Moorish North Africa, and he says that look, we are a poor country, your graciousness. We can't afford to keep buying our sailors out of your kidnapping bondage. So you're going to have to. We got to work something out here. And the emir says, there's nothing to work out here. You pay us the money. And John Adams says, we cannot afford it. And secondly, we do not want to get into a fight with you. And the emir of the Barbary Pirates says, oh, listen, dude, you do not want to get into a fight with us because we don't play by your rules. We don't take prisoners. We don't negotiate. We don't surrender. We don't sign a piece of paper that says we're done. Let's stop the fighting. You win. We don't do that. We'll just keep killing you and terrorizing you till the cows come home. And the end result, of course, is from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. They did have to mix it up. Those two lessons alone. By the way, you know what they were enjoying at the time of that conversation between the ambassador of the United States and the emir of Tunisia, the Moors?
I don't.
They were having a nice cup of coffee. They were enjoying the fine tobacco products from the state of Virginia. They were enjoying the bounty of the New World right there between the two of them over that brand of diplomacy. So That's the, you know, you read that kind of stuff and everything comes alive, and it has absolutely nothing to do with the bushels of wheat that was pulled out of Saxony during the Weimar Republic. It's got some other stuff that's attached.
No, but I think what you're saying is, and don't let me put words in your mouth, but I think it applies to all of us who are fans of history, is that, you know, you grow up with a two-dimensional version of history, especially with our heroes. We shrink them into cardboard cutouts. We sand off all the rough edges and all the unpalatable stuff and turn them into symbols. And then when you are able, like adding water, to restore them again to their three-dimensional human qualities, they become so much more relatable and interesting. And the fact that, and you know, this is the most obvious part, that's still the part that you have to remember, the fact that they don't know how it's going to turn out in the
end. Oh, yeah, exactly.
You know, and the right. You know, for us, it's such a safe thing. We know there's a happy ending. We know he becomes John Adams at the end of this story. Story would have ended differently had he been taken prisoner, you know, and beheaded by the head of the Barbary pirates. I mean, and he doesn't know that's not going to happen. So for me, I think, you know, it's there's a great line. I wrote it down, and I every time I quote anything on the program, I have to be careful because someone will say something like, "That's actually not a real quote." Or, so I have to, but I wrote it down, and it's a Latin line from ancient times that says, "It will give you pleasure to look back on this scene of suffering." And it's a reminder to me that it would be very interesting to go back and talk to somebody, say, from the Second World War, say a refugee, and go to them and say, listen, you have no idea how many tickets we're going to be able to sell to the movie about the experiences you're going through right now. You know, I mean, I think there's almost an obscene aspect to that, right? We're going to be entertained by the most traumatic, terrible thing you've ever gone through. And the only thing that makes me feel like we can get away with it is that those people themselves were fascinated by stories from earlier times that were based of the same sorts of components, you know, human beings dealing with struggle and overcoming the many things that were thrown that way, not knowing how it's going to turn out.
And it is exactly rooted in today's behavior. History shows us the human condition as we can observe it right now across the street. The great novelist Alan First, who I've read, he writes essentially World War II era espionage books. Fascinating, great stuff. Novels, okay, but set firmly rooted in real places, real dates, real times, real upheaval. All of his books, I'm saying all, I may not be 100%, but the ones that I've read of it are all set prior to the Battle of Stalingrad. Why? I heard him say this on the radio, and it made me jump up and down in my car, which I don't recommend. but he said, why are all your books set before the Battle of Stalingrad? And he said, until the Nazis gave up the ghost in Stalingrad, and this is why your Ghosts of the Ostfront really kicked my butt in all the 114 hours of you talking. You know,
that's one of the shorter series too, unfortunately.
He said, until the Nazis began their retreat and were captured there at Stalingrad, no one had any idea that they were beatable. They had taken over their half of the world with relative ease and with constant terror. So you tell me, Stalingrad, they retreated from Stalingrad in 1942?
43, I think, by the end of it. Yeah, but 42 is when the battle happened. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Okay, so not until 1943. So from September of 1939, and actually prior to that, until that moment, the Nazi war machine was invincible. So until you get a sense of, hey, wait a minute, they've lost there. And I'm looking at the map, and I'm looking the way things are going. Holy cow! They could actually lose this thing. They are defeatable. And as a matter of fact, they're losing ground like crazy. You know what? It might only be a matter of time until Nazi Germany is wiped off the map, destroyed. Wow! There's actually hope. Until that moment came, a human being, particularly in that sphere of the world, had three options of how to conduct their lives. They could either be a hero, they could be a villain, or they could be a coward, a bystander. And I always, whenever I'm in the midst of any of these sagas, in any of the midst of these journeys of history and enlightenment, I always ask myself, geez, what would I be? hero, villain, coward? Wow, I'm not so sure of look, I have hubris, but I'm not so sure of at the end of the day when push comes to shove. Am I going to say, hey, look, these are the rules now, guys. They took over. We got to, you know, do we become a member of the Vichy French? Or we do one of those, or we become one of those kids that suddenly wakes up one day, the French Republic has collapsed, and you have either an option to stay or run down to the beach, get in a rowboat, and cross the English Channel and keep the fight going on. That we all face moments like that every single day of our lives. We have some, you know, maybe taken to a ridiculous extreme, or maybe not to an extreme at all, of that choice between what our actions are going to be and what how we're going to view it in years to come. You know, someday we'll be all laugh about this. And it could be that someday we never talk about any of this because we don't want the secrets to come out.
Or it's too painful a memory. You know, I used to say that when I talk to veterans, you can almost tell how much combat and action they saw by how unwilling they are to get into it with you. I wonder how much our fascination with these sorts of incidences would be different had we actually experienced the incidences themselves. I mean, if Tom Hanks had actually fought in the Second World War, as you have in more than one film, how different then is Tom Hanks's portrait? In other words, how much is Tom Hanks exploring a subject that he's interested in because there is no answer, right? We don't know how Tom behaves in the Second World War versus, and I think, you know, I was trying to think, you know, ahead of time. It's funny, not to change the subject at all, but I was trying to do my research for this program, and I went and saw interviews with you that you'd done in the past where you talked about the celebrity mule train and and all the questions you normally get asked. And so I wrote them all down and thought it would be funny to just go through every one of those questions. But it's funny because how many of them get into this thing about what's so interesting about this topic that you continue, because people ask me, my wife says to me all the time, I have to walk out of the there was the Jeffrey Epstein series was on the other day on Netflix or whatever, and she's watching it, and I have to walk out of the room every 2 seconds because I can't handle what they're talking about. And she says, how is a guy who talks about war all day long, but you can't stay in the room during this? And I said, I don't know what the difference is, but I think it has something to do with unanswered questions about how we would be maybe in those situations. You used to read about the veterans who always wondered about, okay, how will I behave? Will I be a coward when the bullets first start? How will that crucible in my life be when I hit the beach? Had Tom Hanks been in these situations for real, as many of the Second World War era actors were, who then came back and had to portray, you know, the sands of Iwo Jima or whatever, how much do you think your portrayal would be different, and how much would you be still interested in exploring these questions? Do you think it's an unknowable question? But
you know, there's a. I'll tell you a story which I don't know, because again, it's a combination of hubris and desire. You know, I would like to seduce everybody by saying, "Oh, I know exactly what." I had no idea. But here's a great story, and some of it is apocryphal. I'm sorry to say, but this is a fact. My friend Ron Howard was in a movie with Lee Marvin, and there was gunplay involved. Lee Marvin was a great guy. He was hilarious. He was gregarious. He got the drill. He knew that it was, you know, part leaning into the truth and part a racket, you know, the movie biz. The movie biz. But he was a great guy until the night gunfire scene came. And he was not the same man that night, perhaps because he had been drinking. But he was not the same man when it came down to shooting this stuff, the gunfight, the muzzle flashes, the bang, I got you. Because he says, oh, you're all pretending here. You're all pretending with your little guns. Now, that's one story that I know I heard that from the horse's mouth. Here's a story that I've heard in happenstance, and I'm just going to assume that it's true. All right. Lee Marvin is on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, he's funny, and he's Lee Marvin, and he's intimidating, and he's all that, and he's been in The Dirty Dozen, and he's been in all these other films.
The Big Red One, all of those.
He's Lee goddamn Marvin, all right? So Johnny mentioned something about being a hero, you know? Somehow the word hero is mentioned. Johnny Carson says, well, you're a hero, Lee. You're a war hero. you served in the Marines. And he says, I'm not a war hero, Johnny. I'm a guy who got shot in the ass. But I will tell you who is a war hero. I believe it was Iwo Jima. Forgive me if I'm wrong. Let's just say it's Iwo Jima because it can stand in for Peleliu, Guadalcanal, Okinawa, Pinian, Kwajalein. It could stand in for all of those island battles in World War II. But he was a Marine, and he did get wounded. He did get shot. He got a Purple Heart, etc., in combat. And he said, I'll tell you who's a hero. The beachmaster at Iwo Jima was a hero. That was a man who was unarmed, and his job was to stand up on the beach under fire from the defending Japanese forces, waving red flags in order to guide the landing craft in to their appropriate landing sites so that the invasion could continue, disgorging their attacking Marines and then going to. His job as the beachmaster was to communicate with signal flags, with semaphores, to the pilots of these small boats, all under fire. He said, now that man was a hero, and that man's name was Sergeant Bob Keesham. Do you know who Bob Keesham is?
Isn't it like Captain Kangaroo or something?
He was Captain Kangaroo! He was Clarabelle the Clown on Howdy Doody.
Oh my gosh. That's some therapy working itself out after the war right there, isn't it?
Well, it is some aspect of that generation who says, hey, first of all, we all signed up for the duration plus 6 months. There were a bajillion of us. Secondly, all of us saw, if you were in combat, you all went through something, you all saw something, et cetera, et cetera. And thirdly, there's that great line from The Best Years of Our Lives when Dana Andrews has been pulled down out of the derelict B-17 that's being demolished and turned into material for model homes. And the guy says, hey, you get down from there. And Dana Andrews comes, I was just reliving it. Oh, yeah? Well, when you fly boys were up there doing it, I was down on the ground in the tanks. And Dana Andrews says, hey, listen, brother, I'd love to hear your war stories if I ever have the time. They all had war stories. And theirs were no different than others. And those guys that did indeed, you know, faced it, you know. I don't want to mention any names, but I know of actors, veteran actors who since passed away, who killed the enemy with their bare hands in foxholes because they had to keep moving. How do you go through that and then come back and either tell about it or laugh about it or view it as some sort of anecdote from the past? It's
an entertainment vehicle, right? A crowd pleaser, an audience applause prompter. You know, that's one of the things, and I was having a hard time coming up with specific questions about your wonderful film, Greyhound, because I didn't want to give away any spoilers. And everything I was going to ask about sort of led to a spoiler. I do want to say, though, one of the things that really grabbed a hold of me and that I got right away was, and you just alluded to it, was that, you know, we celebrate and always have the guys who hit the beaches at Iwo Jima and everything, but you know, always in war they talk about the snake, right? The head of the snake are the combat troops, the tail of the snake are all the people that it takes to keep the combat troops, you know, with bullets and food and all the things that they need to do their jobs. And the more modern the warfare, the longer the tail of the snake gets. The number of people that it took to get the Second World War soldiers to where they could fight and be the head of the snake, you're playing the role of one of these people that essentially is, for lack of a better word, one of the many millions and millions of functionaries who kept the book that the movie's based on, the novel, is called The Good Shepherd. And that's what the destroyer escorts are for these convoys. They are shepherds. They are people who guard the logistical supply train. And they're not the people you normally think of as hitting the beach at Iwo Jima. It's a different kind of heroism, isn't it?
It is. It's delivering the mail through.
Yes, that's what it is.
it's through a maelstrom that could take your life. That you make the wrong turn, you make the wrong decision, you make the wrong assumption. If you're so foolish as to live by assumptions, guess what? You have made the critical mistake of your life. And that now our movie is set in 1942. There is a couple of major buys in it. One of them being that there's an ocean liner that's been converted, and there's 5,000, you know, fresh troops to it.
And this is all historical. Sure. That happened a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it did. And at any given moment, there would be 40 convoys crossing the North Atlantic. Not just one, not just two. They didn't have all their eggs in one basket. They were all different sizes, made up of ships from all the Allied navies, the Poles, the Norwegians, the Canadians, anybody who had a ship that you could load up with anything from bayonets to raw iron ingots, coal, cans of tinned beef, screwdrivers, socks, anything that was desperately needed, not just by the populace of Great Britain, but by the soldiers that were going to at someday take on the Nazi hordes themselves, was delivered there by these ships, slow, rust-buckety ships. I think your top speed, you could only go as fast as the slowest ship in your convoy. Captain Krause and Greyhound are protecting 37 ships in a convoy. The slowest of them can probably only manage about 14 knots. So that's the speed which they are crossing the North Atlantic, heavy seas, wintertime, nighttime, 24 hours a day, zigzagging in order to hopefully either to not be found out or to evade the Nazi submarines, of which there are dozens and dozens and dozens out there looking for targets in order to sink. Every time they sink any ship, it's a plus for them. Sink a ship with troops, great. Sink a ship with jeeps, great. Sink a ship with tires or barrels of castor oil, whatever, great. That's a win. So the guys who are in charge of that who are on board that, the cook on board that one of those ships, the guy who does the laundry. The African American messmates who, because of segregation, are relegated to those duties, except when general quarters are sounded, and then they run off and man their posts. All those guys are literally floating potential casualties that could disappear in the wink of an eye, drown, be blown up, never be seen ever again. And what have they been doing? For how did they serve in the war, Daddy? Well, I made sure that there was enough potatoes served to our crew if the seas allowed us to boil them in hot water, which often was not the case. Usually when I get something from the marketing department, they say, oh, here's the tagline for your movie. I kind of go, okay, all right. There's a little hyperbole in there, guys. I think you're ratcheting it up a little, but not in this case, you know, you can argue more dangerous than the front. Let's just say as dangerous as the front. The odds of you dying at sea, just being a guy on a boat whose job it is to protect a bunch of other slow moving boats, was the same. It's somewhere between wildly out of your favor and possibly in your favor.
You're not a combat soldier until you are in that situation, right? Mm. So let me talk a little bit about the screenplay, because you wrote that. And let me say, as a guy who my dad used to say he could always know how the movie was going to go because he could tell how it was cut. And there's always a Mad Lib quality to these kind of films where you could almost write a template for how they're going to go. And yours wasn't like that. You caught me off guard several times. One thing, when I was trying to learn how to write columns once upon a time, they used to talk about how you should take out every word that you didn't need, and that by the end you have this very tight sort of thing that says everything you want to say, doesn't diminish the story at all, but is as few words as possible. I thought this was an amazingly snappy script. I remember when it ended, I turned around and said, I couldn't believe that we'd already gone through. It didn't drag for a second. And if this was a wine and you were talking about the notes of chocolate and the little bit of oak. I mean, this had overtones of Sink the Bismarck to me, and some, you know, Run Silent, Run Deep, but also some Jaws mixed with some of this idea of, I mean, you were able, and this is what I thought was so snappy, you were able to take me into these, and we love doing this on this history show too, where we'll talk about the moral quandaries and awful choices that people are put into because they're just sort of trapped in the gears of history. Normally, there takes a lot of setup to really get to that moment. And you put me in that moment three or four times in this film, and I found myself in it without any setup at all. I mean, the genius of being able to write it so I was in this moral quandary, and all you had to give me was look in the distance, your character sees something in the distance, we look into your eyes. It would have taken me 15 minutes of conversation and thousands of words to set up that same scene. Do you enjoy the screenplay parts? Because I'm getting tired of all of your talent. Actor, screenplay, executive. I mean, it was you took this from a novel, right? Not to steal one of your four questions from the Celebrity Mule Train list, but tell me a little about coming up with this and deciding you wanted to write the screenplay. I mean, it was a novel, right? A C.S. Forrester piece.
Yes. I purchased the novel from a bookstore that has since got out of business on Madison Avenue in New York City.
Shocking.
And I did it because it was a used bookstore, and not a used bookstore, but it had collectibles, you know, in the front window. And I saw this thing. C.S. Forrester, I was aware of from Horatio Hornblower.
Right.
Okay. Which I never read any Horatio Hornblower. I said, oh, that's a guy who wrote Horatio Hornblower. And the it was the original cover. And it was a painting, a drawing of this very old gray-haired guy on the railing of a ship with his tie askew, the wind blowing into his face, his jacket undone. He just looks spent, beaten. On the horizon behind him, a ship is tilting up, smoking and sinking. Beside him was some formless figure in a helmet that is sending out a signal on a signal lamp. And I said, Who's that guy? Who is that guy? I'm used to that, the trope of the somewhere between Don Ameche and Robert Mitchum as being the guy in command of a boat.
Yes.
Some battle between Burt Lancaster and Clark Gable. You know, I'm used to that. I've never seen some old silver-haired guy who looks like he shouldn't friggin' be there. So picked it up. As of page two, I was enmeshed in Forrester's book that tells the tale of the sequence of days from inside Ernie Krause's head. All of his thoughts, the math that he does in his head, the geometry, the sensibility of when he has to call off the general quarters so that sailors who have been in their posts for the last 5 hours can go to the bathroom, maybe get some rest, have some hot food if it's possible to serve hot food. What it means as far as the time goes. How much time do they have to straighten up the column? Because not all those ships can make the zigzags at the same time. Do you know when the convoys, the convoys were told when to make a zigzag? Either by a prescribed moment of time or by seeing the certain proper signal flags rise up on the mast of the Commodore's ship. That's how they weren't said, okay, convoy, time to make the turn. That did not happen. They just understood that, oh, we have to make the turn now. So 37 ships making a turn to the left or the right by a certain number of degrees is a recipe for chaos. It is literally sheep in a field following the cue of each other, and on the periphery are the dogs that keep them in order.
The good shepherds.
So, yeah, the good shepherds. So everything that happened it's right down to the quality of a cup of coffee or the frustration that he doesn't get to have a full bite of what his sandwich is, or of his wolfing down a meal in a matter of 3 minutes, because he knows that if he doesn't have the calories in his body, he's not going to be able to think clearly, and when the time comes up, he won't be able to do the math or respond. Along with that comes the fact that we know, hey, we know we won the war, right?
Yes.
And we have seen many, many times a sonar guy saying, wait a minute, what is it? I think I hear something. Or radar coming on going bloop, 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 that's showing us where something is. Radar, and particularly 1942, ridiculously complicated
glitchy.
Sometimes all you saw was the crests of the waves, the 20-foot waves on your radar screen. You saw nothing else except patterns of these waves. Even down to the depth charges that in 1942 were bulky, nearly boxy. They were not streamlined. So each one of them sank at a varyingly slow rate. Later on, they had streamlined depth charges. They had hedgehogs. They had all these other weaponry. But in 1942, they were dumping explosive garbage cans into the water, waiting for them to float down to a certain depth and then exploding and maybe damaging something that could be there, could not be there. I've listened to sonar recordings, training records, literally 45 records that you put a needle on. From the era, and it sounds something like this. Example 6, a engine running at 14 knots. Screw noises. Example 7, torpedo on approach. And you're going to tell me that in primitive 1942 headphones, earbuds, a la, you know, FDR's era, that you're going to be able to figure out what that is over a hydrophone that's also fighting waves and what have you? The inaccuracy of all of this stuff preyed on Ernie Krause's mind, and he had to take it all into account. So in the book, there it was. So adapting it was a fever dream for me. I just said, okay, I'm only doing this for myself because, damn it, no one else would take the job. it's very frustrating. I don't want to do this homework, you know. I don't have to sit around and do all this. I was hoping I was going to get one of my great writer pals to take one look at it and just say, oh, turn me loose. First of all, nobody wants to do anybody else's work but their own. And no one wants to be, and by and large, they don't want to be locked into the procedure of adapting something that you have to stay pretty adhere to. So I ended up taking off and I said, I am going to pick every cherry off this tree that I am in love with. And I'm going to put it down here on paper. And it was thick. It had animation. It had mind's eye demonstrations. I wanted to try to communicate somehow that Krause was thinking about where these submarines could possibly be by having swastikas dancing on the waves of where he thought they might be.
Oh, now, that's interesting.
Now, the problem with that is first of all, it blows the budget up because that's a, I mean, our special effects budget here, you know, when you're trying to make all these ships in the sea and everything look like photoreality, that requires a fidelity that ain't cheap. So that was one aspect of it. But coming also into anybody else who read it, to me it was like, don't you see? That's like that's like the imagining. That's what's haunting Krause himself. And almost to a person, everybody who read it down at the office, as well as Aaron Schneider, who was the director of it, he said this: "You're giving it away. You're showing the shark."
Yeah, totally.
And I went, damn you to hell with your logic of all this. So there was that. And there was an awful lot of things. And the paring away of all those things is what is required when you're making the leap. I adapted a book and put it into a 120-some-odd page screenplay. That remains only a blueprint for what has to be the cinematic narrative that is visual and that has to be I was lucky in that we got to be as cryptic as we are, because the uninitiated, and let's call the uninitiated any executive at the studio who sees the movie, will say, Can you help us understand a little bit of what the danger is here, what the stakes are? And I, of course, you know, I have to bite my tongue saying, do you honestly not understand what the stakes are? Well, we just want to know what the jeopardy really is here.
Can you flesh it out a little bit more?
can you give us some hints as to what the conflict is here?
Yeah, this war, is it a big thing? This is a big war, right? We're talking about...
Yeah. So I would, I say, oh yeah, you know what? We're going to add a line so that one of the lookouts will say this: Captain, there's a U-boat on the surface. They might be trying to sink us with one of their torpedoes. And I said, you know, okay, we're not going to have those kind of lines. We had, I was schooled in a lot of this stuff by other directors that I worked with, and Ronnie Howard on Apollo 13. When we were putting it all together, there's this concept of gimbal lock. You do not want the command module on the way to the moon to experience gimbal lock. It's a really bad thing. It essentially negates all of your navigation. You can't tell where you are if the three gimbals lock. Gimbal lock, bad thing. Ron said, "How are we going to know that's a bad thing?" And we said, "Because we're going to say it in a real serious manner." Hey, do anything. Make sure you don't go into gimbal lock. That's all you need. We don't have to talk about the three gyros that handle the X, the Y, and the Z axis. We don't have to go through all. We don't have to go break down and show schematics of the navigational propulsion system in the command. So we were able to enjoy the same sort of faith in being cryptic, as well as letting the nomenclature and the procedure define itself as we went along. The truth is about the pilot house under these circumstances is the only two people that move around who are permanently on watch is the commander, the captain, and the talker who follows him everywhere. The talker communicating by the most primitive form of electronics imaginable. He plugs in his headset into an outlet wherever he is standing, and then stands right next to the captain to repeat everything he hears over his headphones, and then to repeat into the headphones anything the captain says to him. Now, that means you end up hearing stuff from sonar, you end up hearing stuff from the radar, you end up hearing stuff from all over the ship that comes out of the voice and the face of the actor who is playing the talker. Everybody else stands stock still. The helmsman does not move away from that steering wheel. The telegraph operator, the guy who operates the engines, who sends the, you know, forward, back, speed, all ahead, two-thirds, he stands right next to the engine telegraph. The guy who writes down the plot, who keeps the record. Nobody moves for 4 hours at a time. And the nomenclature that goes off, the dialogue that goes back, and they said, how do we know what a con is? How can they keep saying, I have the con, you have the con? What does that mean? And he said, you will figure out over time that one of the most important things for everybody to know on the bridge is who's in charge of steering the boat. So when someone comes on, when the captain comes on and says, Mr. Harbutt, I have the con, that means they don't listen to anybody else except the captain. And when the captain says, Mr. Harbutt, you have the con, Mr. Harbutt says, yes, sir, I have the con. So everybody knows you listen to Mr. Harbutt for all those. So there's never a question. And that's the kind of stuff that becomes, number one, the language of it. I hearken it back to seeing like the Seven Samurai. Kurosawa is a Seven Samurai in the original Japanese. And you're reading the subtitles, but about 3 minutes in, you think you're hearing the Japanese. You know, you think you speak Japanese now because it's all matched up so perfectly. It's the same thing with this. You figure out that, I actually understand the rules now a little bit better, what's going on. Outside of that, God bless C.S. Forrester. He had absolutely no backstory whatsoever. He did not go, and he doesn't go to the Admiralty to show those people pushing around the little model boats as they take, you know, messages from all around. There's no scene in Washington, D.C. There's not even a scene on the Commodore's boat or on one of the submarines. It all takes place, if not in Krause's head, on board the bridge and the decks inside of the Greyhound itself, which is actually a code name for a ship called the USS Keeling. But you'd be amazed at how troublesome it can be to refer to the one ship in your movie by two different names. So they all just became code names. This is a Greyhound. One of the great things that I did not know this until I read it, was the talk between ships. You don't want to talk on the radio when you're at sea like this. You don't want to be constantly getting on the radio and say, hey, I got a problem with this, and can you hurry up and get to me there, and where are we? You don't want to do that because the enemy is listening to anything that comes in. But how do you have that instantaneous conversation between the four shepherds, the four ships that are tasked with this? Well, it was a little thing called talk between ships.
Yes.
Which was a radio.
Very short range.
It was VHF line of sight, meaning that if a ship was on the other side of the horizon, you couldn't talk to it. So you got on very quickly. You spoke in a more or less an abbreviated code. Go back to station. What is your status? Things like that. So that even if, and by the way, the Nazis were listening. They were sitting around on their radios when they were up on the surface, just going back and forth across the VHF spectrum to find the wavelength that the talk between ships was using. And then they'd land on that, listen in for as long as they could. And then they would periodically change in order to monkey around, in order to put in some guesswork. I didn't know that. I thought it was just Dan. The average American knows most of its naval terminology and strategy from watching episodes of Star Trek.
Oh, weird you said that. I almost brought that up. I said there's a little bit of Star Trek in this, one of the real combat-y episodes.
Hailing frequencies, Mr. Chekhov.
Romulans coming, yes.
Romulans. We have this, there's Spock over at his little blue light visor thing saying, he's got the sonar and the radar report saying it might be this, it might be that, they might be over here. The Romulans use a cloaking device. We're not sure where they are. Here's another thing. And this is, again, nobody knows this stuff because we have been accepting the tropes of the cinema of this, in which it's just too hard to explain something as basic as this, except for probably Wolfgang Petersen's Das Boot, which was the granddaddy of all these things. You watch Das Boot, you realize that, oh my God, man, they had to take all that food with them at any given time. One of the toilets was filled up with bread and sausages.
That's right.
They did not have a lot of room in this place. One of the things that is so hard to communicate but was incredibly important is that when a Nazi submarine went under the water, it slowed down to only 6 knots. They couldn't manage much more than 6 or 7 knots. So on the surface, they can keep up with the ship. They can keep up with the convoy. They just got to stay out of sight. They just got to stay on the other side. They got to stay muted and hidden. Anytime they go underwater, they can only go about a third as fast as they could on the surface. Nobody knows that. Everybody thinks, they just, that's how they got there. They went underwater and they found, no. Once they sighted them, then they started going back up and down. And they could not stay underwater for very long. Why? Because their engines were powered by batteries. They were there's a famous submarine plant in the United States that's called the Electric Boat Company. Because they were electric boats, when they went underwater, batteries, electricity powered their screws and drove them through the water. Batteries go dead, especially, World War II era Nazi batteries from 1939. I don't know how long they could tune in the radio. Eventually, they have to be recharged, and the only way to recharge them is to go back up to the surface, where your exhaust from your diesel engines can not only power your boat but also power the generators that recharge your batteries. It ends up becoming such a convoluted thing that if you want to ignore it, you can, but you're cheating the authenticity of all the serendipity of the one damn thing after another aspect of the drama. So there's what could we throw into the mix there dialogue-wise that would communicate somehow that submarines, when they go underwater, have to go really slow. There's one line that Aaron and I and Stephen Graham came up with when we were doing it, when we were mapping out how do we communicate this stuff. And Ernie Krause says to Charlie, you know, can you plot a course on this heading at 6 knots and give us a point of intersection? All right. This much time, them going this speed, us going our speed, we should be able to find them in, you know, like 6 miles. Wow, that's a lot of math. If you really had to explain it outside of a couple of visuals, you know, we show literally a grease pencil and a protractor and a ruler on a map. If you had to really get into it, my gosh, it would just take absolutely forever. So I said, we do it and the audience will catch up.
I'll tell you where you kicked my rear end. And it's not a place that it would have kicked my rear end if I was watching Platoon in the 1980s and I was a 20-year-old, right? You kicked my rear end when I'm watching it, and the captain, of course, is almost a father figure, but the sailors on this ship, so many of them look like kids. You really and what was great about that is after it punched me in the gut, and I was thinking to myself, I still want to know where my 18-year-old is. You know, at midnight, I want a phone call. And these people on this ship are no older than that, and you're looking at them like as a dad going, if that's my kid. And, you know, it was like flying with the World War II guys. They're all like 23 years old. If you told me my pilot on my Delta flight today is 23 years old, I'm not going on that flight. And I'm watching this captain, and he is like these children who turn out to be our grandparents, you know, 45 years later, are there on this ship, and they're looking to this one guy who's on his first mission across with the convoy to protect them and to make the right decisions when he's caught between a rock and a hard place. That's almost the transcendent, that's the historical experience right there of people put in the crux of the moment, isn't it? Where there's no good decisions and they're worried they screwed up, and when they screwed up, people die. Not to quote that Jack Nicholson line, but I mean, that to me in that movie made that person, that captain of that ship, the everyman for me. And this could be you, and what would you do in this situation, and how many times would you replay it in your head for the rest of your days? You know, you really made me feel that.
That gray-haired old man that I saw on the cover of the book is what C.S. Forrester wrote. Ernie Krause graduated from the United States Naval Academy in the early 1920s, when there was no war. He has been in the Navy ever since, and he has never risen above fitted and retained. That's what every one of his promotional ratings have been. Well, here's the good news. You're staying in the Navy. The bad news is you're fitted and retained, meaning you're not getting an extra stripe. You're not jumping up a pay grade. You're staying exactly where you are. So Ernie Krause has ridden a desk, carried a briefcase to him, served on maybe some ships, but not in a wartime capacity. He was probably in charge of keeping track of an awful lot of things. So at the top of the movie, we do have a one quote unquote flashback scene, which is right after Pearl Harbor. A guy who is on his way out of the Navy, probably because of lack of need as well as lack of opportunity, instead is suddenly one of the most important men in uniform. He's got close to 20 years of naval experience as well as rank. So he is now going to be given his own ship because they need a guy in charge of it. He's going to have to go and drill a crew in training, tactics, a bunch of other kids who have just signed up. They signed up the day after Monday, December 8th, 1941. They went in and joined up in the Navy. They're all kids. He is in, you know, let me just say this. I play somebody who's like 48. All right. He is not just if you were 28 years old in the armed services in World War II, you know what they called you?
Old man.
They called you Pops.
Yeah.
So when they're making references to the old man on board Greyhound, they are literally talking about an old man. And not only is he an old man, he's an old man who's never done this before. All of this stuff has only been theory in his head, theory in schoolwork, classroom work, book work. He's been at sea to a degree, but not like this and not charged like that. Aaron, Schneider, the director, the conversations we always had was, we wanted to have, I wanted to have four different watches. We had three, because I believe it was a watch was made up of everybody who was crewing their position for 4 hours, 4 hours on, 8 hours off, 4 hours on, 8 hours off, 4 hours on, 8 hours off. And so we needed fresh faces to help communicate, number one, how much time has passed, but number two, to escape that Star Trek trope of every time Captain Kirk walked on the bridge, it was always the same crew. Uhuru and, you know, Ensign Chekov. We needed guys who looked different, like the faces of the talkers than themselves. We have, I think we have two or three different talkers. The guys who are the helmsmen, we needed a parade of, and they were all, look, I don't know how old they actually are, but they all looked like they were 13 to me.
They did.
and that is accurate. I think there's, Rob Morgan, who plays George Cleveland, one of the messmates. He is a career Navy man. He is an African American who's been in the Navy probably for, you know, he's probably going for, if he doesn't have his 20 years already, he's going to stay in it because it's a great job, you know. Charlie Cole, my executive officer, he's older. He's a career Navy man and probably the doctor, you know, the ship's doctor. You know, he went through medical school, so he's an older fellow. But everybody else on board the ship is probably, the average age has got to be 24 years old. And that could be as young as 18 or even as young as 17 for somebody who cheated on their enlistment.
Which a lot of people did, yes.
Yeah.
Listen, man, it's what a joy. I appreciate you coming on, and it's a great movie. And if we could ever help you promote anything again, or for whatever reason, keep my contact handy in the Rolodex, the old digital Rolodex, would you?
I will do that indeed. Thank you so much for having this first time caller on your show. I really enjoy it.
Take care of yourself, and thank you so much.
Take care, Dan. Bye bye.
My thanks to Tom Hanks for coming on the program. He really does sort of live up to his reputation as the nicest guy in Hollywood. And the movie's great, Greyhound. You can catch it on Apple TV+. And you can follow us, by the way, at Hardcore History on Twitter. We'll keep you updated anytime we release any history content. And hope you all stay safe in these wonderfully uncertain times we're living in. Thanks for listening.
Wrath of the Khans, Punic Nightmares, Apache Tears, and, of course, Ghost of the Ostfront. Just a few of the classic hardcore history titles available from dancarlin.com. Every true fan has heard these favorites. Hey, they make great gifts, too.